By my count, Al Franken has been a guest on this show 5 or 6 times over the years, during which he's taken us inside the making and unmaking of the Franken presidency. He's railed against Rush Limbaugh and then against Bill O'Reilly, and all while being incredibly funny. But I never expected when he was last here in September 2003 for his fourth bestseller, Lies and the Lying Liars Who Tell Them, that he would repay my generosity by becoming the host of a radio show that's on at the exact same time as mine.
Sorry.
Some might wonder why I'd invite the competition to my show, but I've always been very fond of Al Franken, and it's a pleasure to have him back here to celebrate my 20th anniversary at WMYC.
Congratulations.
So tell me, Al, did you pick up stuff from any of the talk shows that you went on during your book tours?
Well, I picked up that I liked being a guest on shows. And
big difference.
One of the reasons that I have a co-host, Catherine Lanfer, who's terrific and who had interviewed me a lot when I went to Minnesota. She was on Minnesota Public Radio. And whenever I'd go to Minnesota, I'd talk to her. I'd be interviewed by her, and we seemed to have a chemistry. And I figured that when I started doing the show, that if I didn't know what I was doing, I could just basically say, just interview me.
Mm-hmm.
So I'd be a guest again. So
because you really are a counterpuncher, don't you think? I mean, some of the funniest things you've ever said to me were things that you said in the course of a conversation, and I assumed occurred to you at that moment.
Well, yeah, which I think is, as an interviewer, when I'm now doing your job, kind of, I listen because otherwise I'm screwed.
Right.
Although, as someone who's done a tremendous number of interviews, you can tell within a few seconds if someone's listening.
Yeah.
And so I...
Or whether they're just coming up with the next question.
Yeah, or the, I mean, I sometimes you do the satellite radio tour, so you'll be doing 15 of these in 3 hours or something, but not of these, but of real short ones, and it's funny how quickly you can tell whether someone's listening while they're talking.
Well, there's also the rustle of paper sometimes.
Yes, there's that, and part of the fact that I sort of have confidence in my ability to counterpunch is that it frees me up to listen.
Mm-hmm.
How
did you react when people from Air America approached you about hosting a talk show? Was it an immediate yes?
I'm sorry, I wasn't listening. No, it wasn't an immediate yes. It took a long time for me to be convinced that it was the right thing for me to do. I was approached before I started writing Lies and Lying Liars Who Tell Them of Fair and Balanced Look at the Right, and in researching that book, I came to the conclusion that it was important to do, and the reason I felt it was important is that part of that book, the first part of that book, is basically putting a lie to the myth that there is a liberal mainstream media, and this is something that the right has been pushing since for years and years and years, for decades. And I believe that the mainstream media has so internalized this critique that it's sort of scared of its own shadow. But there is a right-wing media, and part of that right-wing media is this huge, vast terrain of right-wing radio that people listen to, that people get their politics from. And I felt that it was really important to do.
But hadn't you also changed over the years? It's my sense that something happened between Rush Limbaugh is a big fat idiot and and Lies and the Lying Liars Who Tell Them,
mm-hmm.
that suddenly you realize that you were more interested in politics than you had suspected, that it was one of your interests before. And you used to describe yourself as a comedian first, didn't you?
I still think I am. I still think I am, although I suppose I'm making a transition. There's clearly a reinvention of myself, and clearly I'm more political. The content is more political in a three-hour radio show. I can't do 3 hours of comedy.
Mm-hmm. Although you can try to be funny as often as possible.
Well, yeah, I do, But sometimes I talk very seriously about things, and we do write comedy for the show, and I do we do set pieces, and we have something now that Catherine and I call what do we call it? It's called it's First Read Theater or Cold Read. That's it, Cold Read Theater, because a lot of times we're just. I mean, it's a three-hour show, and I come in the morning or the night before. We have some ideas. I work on them either with Billy Kimball, who's my executive producer, or with Ben Whitler, who's a young whippersnapper, 23-year-old producer. And we're really the ones who write the comedy, and at a certain point, I have to let go of it and get on the air. And so very often, Catherine and I literally are doing cold read theater.
They're just slipping something in front of you, and you have to read it.
Yeah, and I sort of know what it is.
It's an easy way to make mistakes. I know. They always yeah, tell you you should look it over once, although that's impossible in many cases. And sometimes a sentence is written in such a way as to make it unclear whether you put the emphasis on the first word or not. You know, and then you find yourself in the middle of a sentence that where you're not making any sense.
Catherine had a question mark at the end of one sentence that she didn't see there until the middle of the sentence today. And I saw her do the turn on it in a very convincing way. It was very impressive.
So do you find yourself reading newspapers differently than you did in the past? Now you're scouring them for material, aren't you? And probably reading articles you wouldn't have read in the past.
Absolutely. Well, I'm both looking for stuff and also saying, I got to know this. I get
things that you didn't feel you had to know before.
Yeah, or things I didn't have to know.
Right.
Like, I got to really know this. And it'll be on things like issues that, you know, that aren't my, you know, immediate, like, favorite issues to study, but that are really important. So like
privatization of Social Security.
Now, that's something that I'm just fascinated by. And there's no article on privatization of Social Security that I will not read. Mm-hmm. Because I actually, when I was about 14 years old, I wrote into, like, whatever it is, the American Actuarial Society, to find out what it would be like to be an actuary. Because I was thinking, I was really good at math. And so I love the numbers, and I love I actually kind of totally understand the ins and outs of that dispute, and it fascinates me every little turn. You know, whether it's the president and the Republicans now abandoning crisis, or whether it was abandoning privatization and private accounts and changing it to personal accounts. It's a fact that
ownership society is.
Yeah, the words are interesting too, but also the numbers are very fascinating because. If you look at the difference between, for example, the Social Security trustees and CBO, there's a difference. And the difference kind of underlines the extent to which you just really don't know what's going to happen 40 years from now, 50 years from now. So the CBO at 2052 is when the Social Security Trust Fund runs out of money, but at that point it can still pay 80% of the because of money coming in.
So that's
workers.
The Congressional Budget Office's assessment.
That's yes. The trustees are more conservative and more pessimistic, and it's 2042. Mm-hmm. But I love, like, the president does this thing where when he's trying to sell it as a crisis, he says that in 2018 there'll be more money going out of the trust fund than going in. And at that point, it'll have to be paid, you know, the difference will have to be paid by IOUs. Well, the IOUs are treasury bonds. Treasury bonds, the safest investment on the planet. My wife and I invest like retired school principals. And we treasury bonds, they're safe. And what's funny is they've done this. It starts less money coming in than going out in 2018. Well, my question is, okay, if that's your metric, if that's what you're using, when do you start getting less money in? When does less money start flowing in and more going out under your plan? the instant it starts. So it'd be like 2006. So what are you telling? You're not fixing anything. So that's why I love Social Security privatization.
You said you read everything you can on that. Do you also listen to the right-wing radio hosts talking about these things? Listen to Rush anymore?
I don't. What we do on Rush is, and this is cheating, I should sit down every once in a while and just listen to a full hour or something that I can stand. But what we do is we have one of the researchers, and we have to trade this off because it's so obnoxious, the task, they trade off listening to him or actually going through the transcript, which is the Media Matters of America or For America. Media Matters is David Brock organization, transcribes it, and we get that overnight. But they listen to it. And the reason we do that is we have a segment on our show, which we do about a feature that we do about three times a week, which is Mark Luther, who I grew up with. And we went to high school together, and we've known each other and stayed very, very close for about 37 years or something, is a ditto head. Guy's a ditto head, you know, and he lives in Denver. And so every day, not every day, but when we do these segments, I play him something Rush says that is just on its face wrong and ask Mark to defend it. And he usually says, well, that can't be defended, but his bigger point is true. And I'll give you an example. About a few months ago, Rush said that he's talking with a caller about the minimum wage. And of course, conservatives say that that if you increase the minimum wage, that destroys jobs, entry-level jobs. And it never has, by the way, but that's what they say. And so Rush says, 75% of Americans on the minimum wage, my friends, are teenagers in their first job. And so one of the researchers played that for me, and I went, okay, well, clearly that's not true. Let's check this out. So the researcher went to the Bureau of Labor Statistics, and it turns out that 60.1% of Americans on the minimum wage are 20 and above. Okay? So Rush clearly was just taking this 75% are teenagers in their first job just right out of his butt, essentially, right?
I would have said out of the air, but yeah, okay.
No, it was out of his butt, Leonard. And it went out of his butt, into the microphone, through the air, into the brains of ditto heads. And, we got our labor statistics from the Bureau of Labor Statistics. He gets his labor statistics from the Bureau of Russia's butt, is what I'm saying.
So what did your friend say?
Really? Oh, well, maybe he didn't. Are you sure? What are teenagers? What's your first job? I go, wait a minute. Okay. That means that at the most 39.9 are teenagers. But as a teenager, I had like three or four jobs. So you figure maybe 25, 33, well, I'll give you 50% of teenagers on the minimum wage are, well, of course, I had three jobs. Maybe I got more than the minimum wage. I don't know, Mark. He's wrong, you know. And he'll go like, okay, well, he shouldn't have said that.
When you were writing political stuff at Saturday Night Live, you worked with James Downey at times, didn't you?
Yeah, still.
Isn't he also pretty conservative?
He's real conservative, but he's an independent thinker. He really is. And I admire him a lot because he can really wrap his brain around the funny of a situation and clear steer of his own politics.
Chris Buckley is like that. Have you talked to Chris?
I know Chris, and I find Chris to be a gentleman and to be funny.
He finds it funny, right and left funny.
Yeah. Jim and I were, he's one of my best friends, and he and I wrote a lot of stuff together, wrote it with other people, too. But a lot of the political stuff over the years that I was at SNL, I wrote with Jim. And we never felt it was the job of the show to have a political axe to grind. And so we just, we didn't think it was fair to the other people on the show, and we didn't agree. So, but we had tremendous fun writing this stuff. And also, Jim has a very sophisticated sense of politics, a very deep interest in it. And he's written some stuff by himself. That's the Gore-Bush debates of 2000, he wrote, and they were just, I think, maybe the thing that beat Gore, frankly. And I, you know, I hold Jim responsible for every terrible thing that's happened since.
But you're still friends.
But we're still friends.
Has doing this kind of grind, 3 hours a day, every weekday, has it wreaked havoc on your life, or has it kept you home because you're not going out on tour?
Well, it's done both.
So does your wife like this or not like
this? I think she doesn't like it as much as she would like it if... here was the idea. My my kids are now... We're now empty nesters, officially. We have one out of college and one in college. And the one out of college lives in New York, but doesn't live with us and is a elementary school teacher, and the other college is at college. And this was going to be our you know, and
this is when you buy the house in Provence or something like that.
Yeah, kind of. And so this was going to be just a glorious time. there are times where she's not thrilled with it, but she I will say that she's tremendously supportive. When you talked about the papers in the morning, believe this or not, I set up the coffee. Mm-hmm. I set up the coffee at night when I go to bed. That's it. That's all I. That's it. That's what I do at the house. I, believe it or not, get breakfast in bed with the five newspapers. I'm eating oatmeal now, so she and it's this steel-cut oatmeal. It takes like a half an hour for her to make it, and she does.
A loving wife.
I'm extremely lucky, but every once in a while there's a little flash of resentment over the hours because I do have tremendous amount of homework to do at night.
And I suspect you're not reading for pleasure anymore.
But reading for pleasure.
Yeah, like a novel once in a while.
It's been a while, yeah.
It can't be that bad because I hear you've just signed a new contract to do this for 3 more years, haven't you?
It's a little complicated, but that's basically it. And you see, I signed for 1 year originally. And
well, who knew if this thing was going to make it or not?
Well, it wasn't about that. I didn't mind. It, this is what it was about. People assumed that I did that because I was just doing it through the election. And it wasn't that. I was doing it because I didn't know if I'd like doing it. Turns out I love doing it.
We'll take a little break and we'll come back to why you like doing this. I can't figure that out. Al Franken is my guest, the host of the...
How long have you been doing it?
Well, 20 years.
Oh, well, I know here, but...
Oh, before that? Oh, about, I guess it's, if you add it all up together, close to 30 years.
Wow.
Al Franken, host of the O. Franken Factor. Also, there's a record from Artemis Records, the very best of the O. Franken Factor's commentary and skits from Air America Radio. There's Sundance Channel. I don't know whether you're...
Going to be doing that again, picking up in June or something.
Meanwhile, we'll be back right after this. We're back with Al Franken, host of the O. Franken Factor, and a frequent guest on the show until he got another job.
We're not the O. Franken Factor.
You're not calling it anymore?
No, we were hoping to get sued. But he just wouldn't go for it again. He didn't, you know, fool me once. Mm-hmm. Shame on O'Reilly, fool me twice.
He still says nasty things about you.
Oh, gosh, whenever he can.
So what do you
I say nasty things about him. It's a great little
it's a trade-off.
Symbiotic relationship.
And what are you calling the show now?
The Al Franken,
Al Franken Show, which makes more sense. That's what we did. We started off with other names, and eventually it became the Leonard Lopate Show.
Well, yeah. I mean, really, it was...
Some people said, what kind of egomaniacal thing is this? Well, it's the Leonard Lopate Show.
Yeah, well, that's what it is.
So you started off not knowing whether you'd like it or not. You say that you do. Do you feel that you... can have a real impact on the political discourse?
Yeah, I hope to. We're growing. I mean, one thing that happened with the network was the original CEO basically misled everyone, saying that we had enough money, capital, to last for 3 years before we turned profitable, and it was really about 3 weeks. And so, as a result,
what did the CBO say about those projections?
I don't know if there was a CBO. I get it.
Yeah, okay.
I was thinking because
Paul Krugman. You should have called Paul Krugman.
It's funny. I can keep track of sort of macro. I can. I didn't take the micro course. We lost L.A. and Chicago,
and everybody thought that would be it.
Everybody thought that would be it, and so that slowed us down tremendously, because you can imagine how eager affiliates were to sign up with a new network that wasn't paying its bills and could collapse at any second. Then what happened was we had to wait till our ratings came out, and I grew up working in television. I grew up in terms of a career, and where you get overnight ratings, and in radio, really ratings come every 3 months, yeah. But you have
the
to wait
quarterly ratings.
Yeah, quarterly ratings, and you have to wait really a few weeks even after that. So then when the ratings came out, it turned out, oh, I see, people are actually listening. But what was great about O'Reilly, of course, as soon as we ran out, the money thing happened, was, you see, this doesn't work. There's no audience. And it's like, that wasn't it at all. Fox News Channel lost $130 million in its first 2 years. We just, but this guy got us on the air. I'm not going to say his name, but he was not totally truthful with us, to say the least. But we got on the air. And then I just put my head down. I became an involuntary investor for a while, in that I was not being paid. And I just tried to do the best show I could. And it turned out that people were listening. And like one channel in particular, for example, Portland, Oregon, we quadrupled the ratings of that station, and it happened to be a Clear Channel station. Clear Channel took one station, and now they love us.
And that comes as a surprise, because
yes.
Clear Channel has obviously inclined toward the Republican Party. It's made large contributions to the party. It's been accused of actually putting together rallies to support the president.
Sure.
So is it just all business? I mean, you're in 45 markets. I don't know how many of those are Clear Channel, but 45 markets, including Washington, D.C., Cincinnati, Detroit.
Right. We're going to Los Angeles tomorrow on a Clear Channel station.
A different station than the one you began on.
Yeah, actually a much bigger signal. Well, the Clear Channel thing is interesting because God bless them, first of all, for putting us on in all these cities. We've been critical of Clear Channel and continue to be. You know, this concentration of media we don't like. And they own more radio stations than, I think, four times as many as the second largest owner. And that's not good. As a result, though, they have a lot of stations. And they have a lot of stations that aren't working. So we get them. And they find that our format, which is... Someone in radio said to me, you've invented a new format. And I went, what do you mean? We're doing liberal talk radio. I go, that's not a format. The content is liberal. No. It's called now in radio, liberal talk radio. And now there's some imitators coming in. Great. You know, I don't want to do it by myself or Air America by itself. This is great. So, and I remember saying to Joe Connison, though, who's on our show every Friday, I said, Joe, gosh, I hope that Clear Channel isn't putting us on just to get the left off its back, you know. And I hope it's just because they want to make money with us. And he said, no, it's great if they're doing it to get the left off its back. That means it's working what we're doing. Our pressure's working. The pressure to stop the concentration of media. So anyway... I don't thank God for Clear Channel One. I never thought I'd say that. And yeah, Jack Hitt, who is I think the vice chair or the second guy there, he's the guy, I think that's his name, bought the Rangers from Bush and has a very symbiotic relationship with him. I think that's the second time I've used that in this interview, that word.
Relationship?
Oh, symbiotic, yeah. And he was given UTEMCO, I think that's the name of it. In other words, the University of Texas employees' pension fund by Bush when Bush was governor to manage, and about a third of their money went to contributors of Bush. And so it's there's a lot of slushy stuff going on there.
My guest is Al Franken, host of The Al Franken Show on Air America, broadcast in New York on WLIB. This is WNYC 93.9 AM 820. We're online at WNYC.org. You're also doing well on the Internet, I gather. Air America is the fourth most popular radio station, almost 200,000 weekly web listeners. But I probably should mention that the top-rated online radio station is the one that offers electronic dance music. Did you know that?
Yes, I read the same article you read.
Now, let's talk a bit about politics. In retrospect, do you think that John Kerry actually had a chance?
Yeah, I do. I think that he had a chance. He made some mistakes. If he had run a perfect campaign, he would have won. He also is...
What would he have done differently? I know Errol Morris says that although he didn't flip-flop on the issues the way which he was accused of, he flip-flopped on his personality, and Americans picked up on that.
Well, I don't know if he flip-flopped on his personality or the issue. He certainly didn't flip-flop on the issues any more than Bush did. I mean, you know, Bush was going to, we're going to regulate CO2, then we're not. You know, we're going to not have a 9/11 commission, then we are. We are not going to have a Department of Home. I mean, you can go on and on. I mean, he's as much a flip-flopper as Kerry was. And Kerry's position on the war was incredibly nuanced and tortuous, but consistent. I think one of the mistakes he did make was the going for the bait of would you still have voted for the resolution if knowing what you know now? And I don't know why he said yes. His position had always been that I voted for the resolution. He didn't vote for the war, which I believe. He voted for the resolution to grant the president authority to go to war in order to get the president to go to the U.N., in order to get the U.N. to get put the inspectors into Iraq. And the president said this. The president said at the time, we've played this, said at the time, if you want to vote for peace, you got to vote for the authority to give me so I can go to the U.N. Because I'll do it anyway, basically. And so, you know, there are. I think he made a mistake not responding. Obviously, everyone has said this. I'm not the first to say it. Not responding to the Swift boat thing. I think he made himself vulnerable on the Swift boat thing by making such a big deal out of his war record at the convention without also making a big deal about his anti-war record, which is totally admirable. As far as positions on the Vietnam War, history on the Vietnam War, he had the highest moral position you could take. He had his doubts about it. Graduating from Yale, he could have gotten out of it the same way Bush did. He went. Instead, he went. He put himself in harm's way. He was he was a Swift boat captain. And then when he came back, he was against the war and did the right thing. And I wish he had emphasized that. There's a lot of things. But it's all – but so much – Bush made as many mistakes, if not more, and had this awful catastrophe in Iraq that, based on his mistakes and would not admit a mistake. It was a disaster in the first debate, one mistake after another, but it has to do with the media. A lot of it has to do with the media. A majority of people who voted for Bush believe that we have found weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. A large majority of Bush supporters believe that Saddam gave al-Qaeda significant help. And a large majority of people who voted for Bush believe that if we hadn't found weapons of mass destruction and Saddam hadn't given al-Qaeda significant help, that we shouldn't have gone to war.
Now, some people have suggested that the Democratic Party adopt more Republican values, change its positions on abortion, on religion, on gay rights. Even Hillary Clinton has suggested that there should be an attempt to find a middle ground between those who oppose or defend the right to abortion. Do you think that's the direction the Democrats should go in?
I think you got to talk about each of these individually. You started by saying Republican values, and I'm not sure what you mean by that.
Well, the values that have been associated,
okay,
come to be associated with the Republican Party.
Okay, let's talk about each one of those. Abortion. abortion went down during the Clinton administration every year, significantly. And Bill Clinton said he wanted abortions to be safe, legal, and rare. And while he was president, they became safer, they stayed legal, and were rarer. At Bush, they've gone up. And why? Well, because one of the reasons that women say they get abortions, they get abortions because they can't support the kid. And one of the reasons they can't support the kid is they can't have health care for the kid, and they can't afford just the other stuff. And Bush doesn't care about that. I mean, sometimes I believe, and I'm not the one who said this, and it might be Barney Frank, might be somebody else, that the Christian right believes that life begins at conception and ends at birth. So on abortion, I think they should be safe, legal, and rare. And I think we should keep saying, and I said this during the election. I said this during the campaign about Clinton's record on it versus Bush's. On religion, my goodness. I mean, I'm not Christian. I'm Jewish. But from what I understand about the New Testament is that if you took out every passage where Jesus talks about helping the poor, if you cut it out of the New Testament, you'd have a perfect vessel for smuggling Rush Limbaugh's drugs.
In other words, just a few pages.
It would just be full of holes. You'd have all this OxyContin in this book. And you could, and his maid could bring it to him in a parking lot.
And gay rights?
Gay rights is a civil rights issue. And I just think that, you know,
seems to have riled up a lot of Americans.
I guess it has. But you know what? If you really look at it, a lot of this sort of came out of that stupid poll, the exit poll that had, you know, like six issues, you know, the war, terrorism, healthcare, education, and then it had values. As if all those, the taxes, as if all those jobs, as if all those other issues didn't have a value dimension to them. So people thought, okay, values was 21% was the most often chosen. Therefore, this was elected on values. In the eight states that they had referendums, I think it was eight states, on gay marriage, it didn't increase the turnout for the margin for Bush. If there was a margin, I think more Americans are accepting of gay marriage than ever before.
Just one more thing. Mm-hmm. As we said earlier, you just signed on at Air America for three more years. So have you given up thinking about perhaps running for the Senate in Minnesota against Norm Coleman?
No, I noticed that 3 years runs out at the end of 2007.
And Norm Coleman's term runs out in 2008.
Yeah.
So you'd have to move back.
The seat comes up, it runs out, you know, January 2009.
You have to move back to Minneapolis. Is that something you'd want to do?
Oh, yeah. Well, or St. Paul or, you know, St. Louis Park, where I'm from, or wherever. But
Your wife would like that?
Yeah, we have actually been looking at property there.
Didn't Hillary tell you that if your radio show takes off, you would do more good doing it than being a senator?
She did. And
Is she going to go into talk radio, do you think?
I think she thinks that she's probably a better senator than a talk radio host, and I think she might think that I'd be a better talk radio host than maybe a senator. But, I mean, that's part of the calculus. If I feel like the radio show is doing more good than, you know, a run at the Senate. And also, if there's someone in Minnesota who just should be the senator other than me. But I'd like to get that seat back.
Al Franken is host of the Al Franken Show on Air America. You can also listen to some of his best commentaries and skits from Air America Radio in an album from Artemis Records. And it has been my great pleasure to have him as a guest once again on this show.
And Leonard, congratulations, 20 wonderful years.
I'm thinking of running for Senate, by the way.
Where?